Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso. Recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today, we'll have some highlights from the second Republican presidential candidate debate this week, along with some reactions from prominent Democratic contenders. We'll tell you about a historic vote taken by San Diego supervisors calling for the removal of dangerous nuclear wastes at the former San Onofre nuclear generating facilities. As wildfires ravage California, Senator Dianne Feinstein is speaking out on the need to change how fighting wildfires is funded and a bill that she wants to see passed in Congress. We'll have an update on the rainfall totals from this week's big storm, and we'll tell you about a fire in La Mesa that has displaced 17 people. On Crime Beat, hear about a pursuit with a crash landing in Spring Valley. Our newsmaker interview today is with Carmen Bonilla from the Wheelchair Dancers, a San Diego nonprofit group that's doing some amazing things, bringing joy, music, and mobility into the lives of disabled people with some walk and roll. On the second half of our show, our Destination East County hosts will tell you about all the most fun festivals and events coming up across our region, from Julian's Apple Days Festival to Oktoberfests and more. Today, we'll also replay our interview with the founder of Pacific Islanders Beer in Santee, talking about the fast-growing craft brewing industry in our region. On Green Scene, learn about a pesticide that a judge has ordered banned due to its harmful effect on bees. And speaking of bees, here's the buzz. The county has just passed a new ordinance aimed at boosting beekeeping in our backcountry, and we'll have the details. Stay tuned for these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. 11 Republican candidates clashed in the second GOP debate earlier this week. Here are some highlights of the debate from Public News Service.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast. I'm Mary Sherman. And now our top story. GOP hopefuls faced off in their second debate, and the evening was full of bickering and personal attacks. Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump pushed former Florida Governor Jeb Bush into a defense of his brother, former President George W. Bush, by attacking his decision to go to war in Iraq. Former tech executive Carly Fiorina and Trump sparred over how their business careers would help their negotiating power. And then Jersey Governor Chris Christie jumped in.
You know who's not successful? The middle class in this country who's getting plowed over by Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Let's start talking about those issues tonight and stop this childish back and forth between the two of you.
After Senator Marco Rubio of Florida went after Trump's knowledge of foreign affairs, Trump fired back over the senator's voting record, with Rubio admitting and explaining why he'd given up on the U.S. Senate after less than one term.
Because in my years in the Senate, I figured out very quickly that the political establishment in Washington, D.C., and both political parties is completely out of touch with the lives of our people.
The candidates also criticized President Barack Obama's nuclear deal with Iran and disagreed on whether the government should be shut down in order to cut funds for Planned Parenthood.
Now, most polls among Republican voters showed that they believed the winner to be either Donald Trump or Carly Fiorina. One highlight came when the moderator asked Fiorina to respond to Trump's negative comments about her appearance.
Ms. Fiorina, I do want to ask you about this. In an interview last week in Rolling Stone magazine, Donald Trump said the following about you. Quote, look at that face. Would anyone vote for that? Can you imagine that? The face of our next president. Mr. Trump later said he was talking about your persona, not your appearance. Please feel free to respond what you think about his persona.
You know, it's interesting to me, Mr. Trump said that he heard Mr. Bush very clearly and what Mr. Bush said. I think women all over this country heard very clearly what Mr. Trump said.
Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton's campaign responded to the Republican debate with a humorous new ad that points out issues the 11 Republican contenders failed to address, including paid family leave, making college more affordable, providing childcare, supporting equal pay for women, and protecting voting rights. Clinton accused the Republicans of failing to provide any meaningful solutions to help people, and then she ran this clip highlighting just what the Republicans were talking about.
We should defund Planned Parenthood.
I defunded Planned Parenthood.
I defunded Planned Parenthood.
I defunded Planned Parenthood.
I'd like to link these two issues, both of which are incredibly important, Iran and Planned Parenthood.
This is a country where we speak English, not Spanish.
You say that babies born in the United States to undocumented immigrants should not get automatic American citizenship.
Get rid of Obamacare.
Repeal Obamacare. Repeal every word of Obamacare.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, another Democratic candidate, took Republicans to task for ignoring many of the same issues. He also criticized them for failing to discuss the wealth gap between rich and poor in America and issues such as the minimum wage. In addition, he took them to task on climate change in this interview on CNN.
If you listen to the debate, you would not know that most of the people in our country, not all, but most of the people, in fact, do believe that we need comprehensive immigration reform and a path toward citizenship. That's the majority opinion. And yet there was virtually no Republican on that stage who agreed with that. I also found it remarkable that some of the really important issues facing our country, for income and wealth inequality, not discussed at all. The fact that we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major country on earth, not discussed at all. The fact that the scientific community is virtually unanimous in telling us climate change is real. It is a real threat to this planet. These guys have nothing to say on that issue.
This is Leon Thompson with important news from the ECO report provided to East County Magazine on KNSJ. San Diego County's Board of Supervisors made history this week. Californians have never voted on whether to demand the Department of Energy remove nuclear waste. As San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station is decommissioned, a toxic waste dump is being built 600 feet from the Pacific Ocean and roughly the same distance from the Interstate 5. Unless some action is taken, 1,400 metric tons of spent nuclear fuel will be stored there. The Board of Supervisors voted 4-0 to support legislation that would remove and relocate spent nuclear fuel stored at the decommissioned San Onofre Generating Plant outside of the San Diego region. East County Supervisor Diane Jacobs stated, "Spent nuclear fuel has no place in San Diego County. As San Onofre is decommissioned, the United States Department of Energy needs to step up and find a permanent place for this deadly material." Supervisor Ron Roberts stated, "Our focus must be to keep the pressure on the federal government to do what it promised many, many years ago. For the sake of the citizens of San Diego County, and indeed every other community where this waste is piling up, the Secretary of Energy must act. Get this dangerous fuel to a place of safety. Live up to what was promised," added Roberts, who joined Jacob in bringing the motion forward. There are 8.5 million Californians spread between San Diego and Los Angeles within the threatened area if there was a major disaster, according to the ECO report, which adds that Charles Langley, the executive director of publicwatchdog.org, reports the San Onofre nuclear waste dump is currently operated by Southern California Edison, which is in line to receive $4.2 billion in ratepayer monies to maintain safe operation and cleanup of the dump. Southern California Edison's current plan is to store the waste in gigantic steel drums that are designed to last for at least 20 years. Adding to the dangers of the fragile dry cask storage containers is the fact that a major nuclear release at San Onofre has the potential to poison as many as 147,000 vehicles and their passengers who travel by train and car past the San Onofre nuclear waste dump every day. Supervisor Jacob observes, "There's no foolproof way to completely protect the public from this material. It's even harder to safeguard Southern Californians when the radioactive material is stored between a major freeway and the ocean. The possibility of an earthquake or other natural disaster at San Onofre, or even a terrorist attack, would continue to be an endless concern." The federal government has talked in the past about developing a long-term plan to store spent nuclear fuel at a remote location or locations. Supervisor Roberts concludes, "It's time to finally make it happen. Too much is at stake," he added, citing lessons learned from Japan's Fukushima nuclear meltdown, which shows the critical need for a long-term solution to storing nuclear waste. As a result of the supervisor's vote, San Diego's chief administrative officer will draft a letter to the United States Secretary of Energy urging the prompt removal and relocation of the spent nuclear fuel currently stored at the decommissioned San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station. Copies will be provided to San Diego County's federal legislative representatives, the governor of California, the state legislative delegation, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the California Energy Commission, and other appropriate agencies or entities.
This is Miriam Raftery with an education report. Grossmont Union High School District's board majority voted last week to approve funding a study on the feasibility of asking voters to approve more bond money. That could be a tough sell to voters, since the district is being sued by Alpine taxpayers for failing to spend Prop H and Prop U bonds to build an Alpine High School, a top priority project spelled out in both of those bonds. The district has claimed enrollment triggers weren't met, but multiple knowledgeable insiders have reported that the triggers were met. The vote came after Board President Robert Shield attempted to blame Alpine parents and taxpayers for the district's current financial challenges. Shield gave a report in which he blasted the Alpine residents' lawsuit as a waste of taxpayer money. Shield said the lawsuit has cost the district $3.4 million so far. Board member Jim Kelly also chimed in, stating, "I don't think the public is aware of the damage being done by a handful of special interests," apparently a reference to the parents and the Alpine taxpayers who filed the suit. Kelly accused Alpine residents of causing so much obstruction, so much delay, and wasting taxpayer money. Though the district claims the suit is frivolous, the Alpine parents and taxpayers have won support from the San Diego County Board of Education, which recommended that Alpine be removed from the Grossmont District completely and moved into the Alpine Union School District so that it can build the long-promised high school that parents have been fighting for 20 years to get. A Superior Court judge also found ample merit in Alpine residents' claims. He ordered the Grossmont District to put bond money into an escrow account and make sure it is not spent on projects other than the Alpine High School. Those funds will be moved into the Alpine District if the State Department of Education ultimately approves the district split called unification. That's after the county grand jury found the board misappropriated bond monies on projects not even listed in the bond in a scathing report titled "Fool Me Once, Fool Me Twice." The grand jury told the district to set a firm timetable to build the school or cooperate with efforts to unify the Alpine Union District and allow parents to leave Grossmont. But the board did neither. The board failed to mention those facts in its presentation last week, however. At the board meeting, District Executive Director Katie Ride also gave an update on the status of Propositions H and U. She showed a PowerPoint presentation with construction updates of the various high schools in the district, blaming those delays once again on the lawsuit since a judge forced the district to set aside that bond money for the Alpine High School, and so the district has cut its funding for some other school projects. Left unstated was the fact that the board spent off substantial bond money already on major projects that were never listed in the bonds. If it hadn't done that, perhaps it would have enough money to finish these current construction projects that are in the bond. Nick Marinovich, a former Citizens Bond Oversight Committee member who resigned his position in protest over the committee's failure to provide adequate oversight, in his view, addressed the school board. He accused the board of fiscal irresponsibility, adding, "The bond oversight is a joke." The board then voted 4-1 to approve the feasibility study anyway on asking voters for more bond money, with only trustee Priscilla Schreiber voting no. The board also approved reappointing David Gvendrew as the Prop U Citizens Bond Oversight Committee Board Vice President, even though, Schreiber noted, he has missed the last four meetings of the group, which only meets quarterly. That vote was also 4-1, with Priscilla Schreiber voting no.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Wildfires, unlike earthquakes or hurricanes, are not funded as natural disasters, and the money to fight devastating fires is running out. Now, Senator Dianne Feinstein, a California Democrat, has issued a statement urging Congress to pass the Wildfire Disaster Funding Act. Senator Feinstein states, "California is suffering from one of the worst fire seasons in decades. More than 7,000 fires have burned this year to date, consuming more than 740,000 acres of land. Fire chiefs say they're seeing some of the more dangerous fires ever, fires that move faster and are more intense than past years. Thousands of firefighters are battling at least a dozen blazes that have burned close to 1,000 homes and consumed hundreds of thousands of acres this year in California alone. Nearly 1,000 homes lost and tens of thousands more homes and businesses are still threatened. Two firefighters have been killed and four firefighters remain hospitalized. An elderly woman unable to evacuate her home was also trapped by the flames and died, while tens of thousands have been forced to evacuate. Senator Feinstein advises, unfortunately, the way we pay for firefighting activities worsens the situation. The Forest Service this year will borrow $700 million to fight current fires, money that was intended to prevent future wildfires by removing brush and dead trees. This approach means California and other western states will be even more vulnerable to devastating wildfires next year as vital prevention programs are delayed, and sometimes indefinitely. She adds, Wildfire Disaster Funding Act, a bill introduced by Senator Wyden that I strongly support, would help solve the problem. Under the bill, if passed, once fire spending exceeds a certain threshold, firefighting would be funded through a separate disaster account. The bill would fund wildfires the same way other natural disasters like hurricanes and tornadoes are handled, through disaster funding. Feinstein concludes, no one should have to worry about getting appropriation of additional funding to fight fires in the driest conditions in 500 years. I applaud the administration for supporting this proposal, and I'm hopeful that Senate will act on this bill as soon as possible. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Tasha Matthews.
An early morning fire on Tuesday destroyed the Roadway Inn on Spring Street in La Mesa, sending occupants fleeing from 17 rooms. At 4:42 a.m., Heartland Fire Rescue crews responded to reports of the fire, arriving to find heavy smoke and flames coming from the roof. Heartland firefighters, with help from the San Diego Fire Department and CAL FIRE San Miguel, knocked down the fire in 40 minutes. The blaze caused $1.5 million in damages to the Roadway Inn, which is considered a total loss, according to Heartland Fire and Rescue. The cause of fire is under investigation. No injuries were reported. Those displaced by the fire have been assisted by the American Red Cross. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is DeVario Bell.
The National Weather Service reports that Tuesday's storm, remnants of Hurricane Linda that drenched our region, has broken rainfall records. Lindbergh Field got 1.21 inches of rain on Tuesday alone, breaking the previous record for September 14th set 109 years ago, and the old record was just over a tenth of an inch. Tuesday was the second wettest day in September ever. The worst was back in 1939 when three tropical storms walloped our region. Sunny skies are returning, however, with high temperatures 5 to 10 degrees above normal forecast by Sunday. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Tasha Matthews.
This is Liz Albert with the Crime Beat Report. 24-year-old Aston Phillips was arrested after a pursuit and crash in Spring Valley early Tuesday morning. Phillips was driving a green Ford Explorer without its headlights with two passengers inside just before 3 a.m. on Kempton Street in Spring Valley. A sheriff's deputy attempted to stop the vehicle. Phillips failed to stop and the pursuit began, but ended after the SUV barreled through a wood and metal private property easement barricade on Quarry Road. A deputy drove up to the vehicle as it was parked along Prey Street in Bonita, but by that time, Phillips had fled again. Phillips was found walking on Quarry Road near Elton Place around 5:15 a.m., where he was arrested. He has been booked on suspicion of evading, vandalism, and driving with a suspended license. The two passengers, who have not been identified, were found after Phillips abandoned the damaged vehicle. They were initially detained, but later released.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers.
This is Leon Thompson with East County Magazine, and my special guest today is Carmen Bonilla, and she is with WheelchairDancers.org. Welcome to our program.
Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor.
Tell me, how did Wheelchair Dancers organization get started?
The Wheelchair Dancers organization was started back in 2008 by our founder, Chief Executive Officer Beverly Worthing. She was diagnosed with limb girdle muscular dystrophy, and through Sharp Grossman Hospital Foundation, she was encouraged to begin dancing again in a wheelchair.
So she was previously a dancer, and then she became wheelchair bound and started this organization for wheelchair dancers.
Yes, that's exactly right. She began with a few students at a time, and we've grown to sometimes 40 to 60 students at a time.
And this all started in 2008?
Yes, sir, in 2008. And we've gone full force since then.
Now, was this the first ever wheelchair dancers?
It was the first one in the West Coast that I'm aware of. Yes, sir. It's an amazing organization. You can check our website, www. Wheelchair Dancers Organization, and check to see our videos and our large contingency of dancers.
And recently you won an award.
Oh, yes, we did. We were awarded the Breaking Away Award of Excellence, which was founded by KUSI and Torrey Pines Bank. We are the first organization recognized for this award.
Wonderful. And what does that mean, the Breakaway Award? What was that?
Yes, sir. That's exactly right. We founded this organization, like I said, back in 2008, and we broke away to the point where we are today. And matter of fact, we just had an event on the 29th of August that brought in over 400 individuals to see our organization and to support us.
And I hear you danced on the television.
We sure did. We challenged Brad Perry from KUSI to dance in a wheelchair, and he took us up on the challenge. And they did a whole 2 hours coverage on live Good Morning San Diego.
How did he do?
Oh, he did really well. He is such an amazing person, but we've had such a great time with him. But we had an opportunity to show our public what the organization is all about and the preparations that it takes for us to put on such a big event.
What are the benefits to the wheelchair dancers?
Well, there's different things that a person can get out of it. It all depends on their ability and capability. We concentrate on upper body and core strength. It has increased the balance, the endurance, and even the respiratory control of a person. The range of motion, muscle tone. It has also increased self-confidence. We have dancers that have started with us and today are very open, very smiling, and they're, oh my God, the continuous effort that they put into the classes themselves. We can see the actual change in a person from day one to where they are today.
So it benefits even the walkers.
But of course. I mean, I have to speak from experience. When I first came to the dancing, to one of the classes, I came in as a volunteer. I danced twice with them, and the actual the self-gratification that I get out of being a part of such a great organization, to be able to help someone to reach those goals, gives me an opportunity to catch up with my dancing and my ability to be a giver.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And you're a Latina and you're a dancer.
Oh, well, yes.
So did you find a home here or what?
Oh, of course I did. I not only found a home with the dancing, but I also found a home with the past experience that I've had to work with nonprofits and to do something for the community and to give them something that I can afford to do, which is my time, my efforts, and my experience.
The organization has both standing dance volunteers as well as wheelchair-bound volunteers. So you actually have what you call walkers.
Yes.
And rollers.
Yes.
So you're doing walk and roll.
Yeah, you could actually say that's exactly what it is. Wheelchair dancers are confined to wheelchairs. So therefore, we call them rollers because they're rolling around in the dance floor.
Yes.
Walkers are our standers, which are persons like myself that are not confined to a wheelchair, mm-hmm. that are dancing with the partner. So we call them walkers and rollers.
Now, this art of dancing with walkers and rollers, you've brought this to a new level.
We sure have. We have our dance instructor, Joe Torres, has designed dances that are based with the cha-cha, the lindy, and waltz, adapted them to dancing with a roller so that it's easy for us to understand the spacing that it needs to have, the timing that it has. He's very, very knowledgeable in that area. So we're very glad that he's become a standard part of our organization for sure.
What has been the impact of Wheelchair Dancers Organization since its inception and since 2008? And what are some of your accomplishments?
Well, just the fact that we're reaching people with physical challenges by teaching them forms of different dance areas, that's a major one. The changes in their physical, mental, and emotional stability is another one. And I think that we've made a great impact in that. And not just for our rollers, but our walkers as well. Because I, for one, walk away there with a big smile every time I participate.
So what's up in the future for Wheelchair Dancers Organization?
Well, let me tell you. First of all, our classes began on Thursday the 17th, and they go through November the 5th. They're going to be held from 10 until 12. They're going to be at the Parque de la Cruz Gymnasium at 3901 Landis Street in San Diego. We're always looking for walkers, so please check our website for those classes. Now, in September 24th at 5 o'clock, we are going to be at the Oregon Pavilion, and we're going to be the first organization to be asked to open up with a five-minute medley of the Beach Boys songs for the ISA World Adaptive Surfing Championship.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Are you going to do that on the beach?
No. We're doing it in the Oregon Pavilion.
Oh, okay.
As a means of bringing everyone through Balboa Park, which, you know, are celebrating a centennial this year.
Yes. Yes. Well, that's a real honor then.
Yes, it is.
That's wonderful. What is your website one more time?
www.wheelchairdancers.org.
Well, that's easy to remember.
And yes, it
says everything about you, doesn't it? And it says that you're a nonprofit. We appreciate you coming. And is there anything that we've not covered or that you wanted to say that we haven't got to?
Well, we want everyone to know that we are doing so many different things. December 12th, we're part of the Nice Guys Christmas Party. We've been asked 3 years in a row to come back and be a part of that event. And also in February, we're going to be with the Los Angeles Abilities Adaptive Expo, where we will be performing 3 days in a row, plus we will have a booth at the expo. So we look forward to everyone coming out there and supporting this great organization.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. It's a great honor to be here.
This is Liz Albert with the Sports Report. CBS Sports reported Tuesday morning that the SDSU men's basketball team is under investigation for improper benefits given to prospective student athletes by a coach. Impermissible benefits are gifts given to prospective student athletes or to their friends or family members that are not available to the public, such as use of vehicles, admission to an event, or a cast. Tuesday afternoon, however, the SDSU Athletic Department claimed that it was not under investigation and had not been contacted by NCAA officials. With all of this in mind, the question on the mind of Aztec basketball fans is the team being investigated or not? Reported for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Liz Alpern.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Rebecca Williamson.
And Leon Thompson, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
This is Leon Thompson.
And this is Miriam Raftery, guest hosting Destination East County. This week's Destination East County features the Chaldean American Festival in El Cajon, a music festival with Apple Pie and Julian, a live musical theater production, and Supervisor Jacob with an event for seniors.
Plus, we'll have a preview of coming attractions, including Julian Apple Days, Oktoberfest El Cajon, hosted by the German American Society, followed by a new event, Fall Fest in La Mesa, and a water issues forum in La Mesa.
So stay tuned for all of these events and much, much more.
The Chaldean American Festival will be this weekend, Saturday, September 19th and Sunday, September 20th, from 5 p.m. to 10 p.m. in the El Cajon Centennial Plaza, where Rhea Street meets Soulsfold Street next to City Hall in downtown El Cajon. The Chaldeans are Iraqi Christians, Many who have lived in East County for generations, and some who recently have become refugees from the conflicts in the Middle East. Chaldeans are one of the ancient cultures of Mesopotamia, says event organizer Dr. Nori Barka. And we welcome all our friends and neighbors to come learn more about us and where we came from. This is a free family event and will feature authentic homemade Chaldean fare, traditional music and dancing, games for children, as well as local vendors for all to enjoy. Proceeds from this event will benefit the Boys and Girls Club of East County and the Adopt a Refugee Family Drive to support families fleeing the Middle East due to ISIS. Again, that's Saturday and Sunday, September 19th and 20th, in the middle of downtown El Cajon.
This year's Julian Music Festival will celebrate its 46th anniversary on September 19th with a diverse lineup of musical acts and a new event beneficiary, the California Wolf Center in Julian. The festival will take place from 1 to 6:30 p.m. on the grounds of the Mangini Winery in Julian. This year's festival will feature a varied collection and blends of musical genres, including Latin jazz, adult contemporary, alternative folk, Celtic music, and more. For tickets and details, you can visit julianmusicfestival.com.
Poway on Stage, the foundation that supports the Poway Performing Arts Center, will present Blue Sky Riders in an acoustic concert to open the center's silver anniversary season. The show will take stage on Sunday, September 20th at 7 p.m., featuring Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Kenny Loggins and Nashville songsmith Gary Burr and Georgia Middleman. Blue Sky Riders combine harmonies with elements of country, pop, and Americana. For tickets and details on the full season lineup, you can go to powayonstage.org.
Author Roger Conley will be speaking at the Lemon Grove Library on September 23rd at 6:30 p.m. about his new book, Dare the Devil, set in 1940s Los Angeles, where gangs, cops, and strange earthlings inhabit the mean streets.
Supervisor Diane Jacob will lead the Don't Get Hooked event on Wednesday, September 23rd, starting at 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. at the Ronald Reagan Community Center on Douglas Street in El Cajon. Learn how to avoid getting reeled in by financial scammers and other crooks. This free presentation and lunch is geared towards seniors and caregivers and will be led by County Supervisor Diane Jacob. Speakers will include scam victims, Sheriff's Department Detective Maureen Perkins, and Deputy District Attorney Paul Greenwood, an expert on elder abuse and financial crimes. Experts from County Aging and Independent Services, the Assessor, Recorder, County Clerk's Office, and Treasurer Tax Collector's Offices will also be on hand to offer advice and answer questions. They will also provide take-home materials and talk about some of the most common swindles, including the grandma scam and the IRS scam.
La Mesa Conversations, a brand new civic volunteer group, has announced a series of public programs to enrich La Mesa's civic dialogue on issues of importance to city residents. The first program will be held September 23rd from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the San Pasqual Winery Tasting Room on La Mesa Boulevard. The topic is the future of water in La Mesa with panelists from Helix Water District, the Water Conservation Garden, and the Water Reliability Coalition. Now for a preview of coming attractions.
As part of Julian's Apple Day celebration, a two-day Apple Day festival will be held September 26th and 27th at Mangini Winery, featuring apple displays, music and dancing, an antique tractor display, children's games and activities, gold panning demonstrations, a beer and wine garden, food and merchandise vendors, contests, and of course, apple pie. The events run from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. both Saturday and Sunday. The coronation for Mr. and Mrs. Apple Days will be held on Saturday. The event began back in 1909 with apple ranchers celebrating their harvest. Back then, the event included an all-night dance at the town hall and trick riding by local horsemen, drawing about 2,000 people. Today, Julian celebrates its apple season for a full 2 months, drawing tens of thousands of people, with the festivities culminating in the Apple Day celebration September 26th and 27th. The same weekend, you can also enjoy an Oktoberfest in downtown Julian and melodrama performances by Julian's Doves and Desperados, as well as the Laguna Mountain Rendezvous with historical reenactors just down the hill in Santa Isabel. For details, you can check visit julianca.com.
Oktoberfest has been a tradition in La Mesa's downtown village since 1942, drawing over 100,000 attendees in recent years. This year, the La Mesa Village Merchants Association is planning to host Oktoberfest on Saturday and Sunday, October 2nd and 3rd, from noon to 10 p.m. This year's festival goes back to its roots with a focus on German heritage. The Bavarian Biergarten Band, Alpine Gemütlichkeit dancers, and the Elkhorn German Band highlight the entertainment. There will be German food, including bratwurst and real German beer, served up at two beer gardens plus vendors. For details on this free event, you can visit the La Mesa Village Merchants Association at lmvma.com.
The German American Societies of San Diego will host their traditional Oktoberfest the first two weekends in October on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, October 2nd through 4th and October 9th through 11th in El Cajon. You can enjoy authentic German food and barbecue, a variety of German pastries, and authentic German music. There are also vendor and craft booths as well as Kids Fun Zone. This annual celebration will be located at the German American Society's headquarters at 1017 South Mollison Avenue in El Cajon. For more information, visit OktoberfestElCajon.com.
La Mesa's Chamber of Commerce will present Fall Fest, a brand new festival to be held on October 16th and 17th at Grossmont Center in La Mesa. This event features country and rock and roll musical artists, including Brent Payne, winner of the Best Country Song of the Year award at the Hollywood Music Awards in 2012 for his hit single, Now and Forever. He's nominated again this year for his song, Midnight Prayer. A beer garden, food, and more are also part of the fall festivities at this event. For more information on Fall Fest, you can visit lamesachamber.net.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all these events and more on our calendar and in our festivals and events section online at eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers.
This is Ed Barreno with East County Magazine's Brew Beat, covering craft beer in East County. And today, I am in studio at the East County Wellness Center with a special guest, Kuipu Lawler. And he is a co-founder of the Pacific Islander Beer Company. Kuipu, thanks for being here.
Aloha. Thank you for having us.
Just I wanted to ask you a few questions about what it takes to start a craft brewery in San Diego.
To open a brewery in California, it takes a ton of paperwork. So it's first find a location. Once you find a location, that location has to deal with gas and water, the two main things that you're going to need when you open a brewery. Okay. So you'll tend to look at a lot of buildings, but you'll find the building that has the best water flow coming in and the building that has gas, because in San Diego, back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, SDG&E forced a lot of them through rebates to do electric only.
Ah.
Then you, once you have your location, and then you go to the city and you get city approval that that building can be a manufacturing facility. And then once they okay it, then you go to ABC, and that's the California Alcohol Board. And then once they okay you, which is about a couple month process, then you'll go to TTB, which is a federal licensing. So okay. They're all actually licensing stamps to be able to pay taxes on your beer.
What is the significance of having gas? Is it for heating?
Okay. Gas is really important because, you know, you could do it with electric. It's burners. You need a couple of gas burners, and gas is a lot cheaper than electric.
Okay.
So most of your brew houses are all gas. And then later on, as you get really big, you have to put in boiler rooms, and you're going to have them gas driven versus electric driven.
Interesting. Okay. And so how much work goes into making a batch of beer as far as your materials? Like, I know you guys use barley and hops and water. Like, about how long does it take before you get the product?
Well, when you're looking at a batch of beer, the bigger the batch is, and let's say we're talking about a microbrewery, not a home brewer, but actually the same time that a home brewer makes 5 gallons of beer in the 20 hours that he puts in from start to finish and before drinking, it's about the same amount of time that you can do 60 barrels of beer, which is 120 kegs of beer in a brewery. The time is the same. Now, you're using different products, bigger volume of products when you're talking about your malt, your two-row wheat, your hops, your yeast, any other flavors that you want to add into your fermentation tank after you've gone through the brew house. But when it comes to cost, the size of the brewery totally helps you stay in business versus the smaller the brewery. The smaller the brewery, you're going to put in, you know, 20-hour days between your tasting room and delivering and making beer. And then normally you can't make enough beer. And right now our brewing equipment is on its way from China. So we have a microbrewery system that we can make up to 40 gallons of beer. But then we also contracted with Twisted Manzanita and they're brewing right now. We start off with 20 barrels each batch and ran out in the first couple weeks. And then we went to, 30 barrels and we still couldn't hold on to, our customers because our first 2 weeks we sold, roughly around 45 barrels of beer. So that's 15.5 gallons times 45.
Right.
And then we went to small pours, just to try to give everybody a chance to taste it, pulled all our beer back out of the places we put it in. And then now the last batch of the Likey Likey Honey Blonde, we just did a 60 barrel batch. So we got about 110 kegs out of that batch.
Wow.
And normally that's what happens when you say a 30 barrel of beer and that's, you know, 60 kegs.
Okay.
It's 2 kegs per barrel.
A 15-gallon keg is a half barrel of
beer. So, okay. But you lose in, you know, the whole process. You probably lose, you know, 10 to 12%.
Angel's share, what they call
yeah,
it.
Yeah, you know, or some of it's just the, you know, evaporation and, you know, when you're, you know, taking the yeast out and, you know, the hops out, you're losing volume.
Oh, okay. Makes sense. Yeah.
So, you know, say you're making 30 barrels of beer and it should be ultimately 60 kegs. It's probably going to be closer to maybe like 55 or 56 if you're really good at it.
Okay. Awesome. You have a Pacific Islander theme. You're Hawaiian. And so I just wanted to find out if there's anything specific about your beer that's different because it's sort of an island style versus a mainland style.
I would think that what our Pacific Islander Beer Company stands for is how we treat people. And that's probably more of what, who we are, is that we want to share the Islander spirit, not just the Hawaiian Island spirit, but all Pacific Islanders. There's over 20,000 islands that encompass that Pacific Islander, realm. Yeah. So, you know, it's more of us being that, showing the customer that comes to us.
The aloha vibe.
That aloha and that Pacific Island type of spirit. So that when you come in, it's a place that, and even if you took the beer home, it's a comfort to drink the beer and slow down your life and have a good moment. I think most of our beers right now are geared to more what the taste bud is of our industry. Our Honey Blonde to our Dakin or IPA. Towards our double IPA Mobetta, our kind of big joke about Mobetta was a lot of people make great IPA, double IPAs, but we make Mobetta.
Yeah, I had that the other day. It's almost triple IPA in the bitterness realm. It's really, really strong.
It did. We're gonna the next batch we're doing next week, we'll be kegging Dakin this week. Our next batch that we'll do of Mobetta, we're gonna unfilter it. So unfiltering is going to even bring out more because when you filter it, it gives it that nice look. But a lot of your hops and a lot of your, like we use Centennial and a lot of them, sometimes the lesser hops kind of disappear.
Right.
So we're going to switch and so it's going to be a little more. It's not going to be more hoppier. It's going to be a more full flavor. You know, you're going to drink the beer and you're going to go like, oh, I know that hop. Yeah, you know, I can taste that in there. And most double IPAs today are reverting to that.
Right. I noticed that. So that, if you see a beer that's very clear, that is most likely filtered.
Sure.
Whereas a nice thick kind of can't quite see through it
that's going to be unfiltered.
Yes. And people think unfiltered because that's kind of like a homebrewer. Was unfiltered. You didn't filter your beer. And so it was a little more cloudier, but people think unfiltered is like, you're going to have chunks in the beer. No, it's still, it's just going to be not as golden or, you know, won't have that color, but it also eliminates a lot of the flavor. So, we kind of talked about it.
I'm excited for that.
Know, and I think it'll be a better, you know.
It'll be mo better, better.
Yeah. There you go. Remember that. Mo better, better.
Okay. So, I noticed, there's a few breweries in Santee. It's kind of the hotspot for, East County Brewing now. And so what are the advantages of doing business over in Santee?
I think our, when we first were looking at opening the brewery, my nephew came to me, Will Fox, our head brewer, and he said, you know, I'd like to open a brewery. And so I told him, you know, I'll financially look at it. And me and the wife traveled to probably about 100 breweries all over the place to kind of see what the industry was like. And this is in 2013. And then kind of got a view and I saw the positive and the negative of breweries. So we brought back the positive. At that time, we went to San Diego, the city, and talked to them. We talked to El Cajon about opening a brewery. We talked to Vista, which was very, it would have been really easy to open Vista too. We're all down here in the East County, all but our head brewer who lives in Vista. but everybody else was down here. And so we then met with Santee because, you know, a couple breweries already here. Mm-hmm. And we thought like, you know, go see it. After meeting with them and for 1 hour, we knew, you know, pretty close this is where we go. We went to a city council meeting because I would suggest that to anybody that wants to open a brewery is go into the city council meeting and introduce yourself to them. Talk about, you got that 3 minutes of time, just like anybody else, but you know, show them that, you know, you want to be a new business and engage how they respond back to you. The city of Santee was outstanding. I mean, they actually made us stay. And then afterwards, we end up talking to them for like, I mean, almost probably another 45 minutes about the brewery, and they were excited. And then once we met with the city council, the governing body, then we met with planning and building, and they were totally excited. They totally kind of like, and it was a year-long process. I mean, if you, anybody out there that wants to open a brewery or are welcome to come to other breweries. Everybody from Jeff at Twisted Manzanita, Ray at Butchers, and now we have Tom running BNS. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're all, you know, we all work together. We all talk. We all check each other's product out. I was just at Twisted Manzanita last night drinking at Chaotic. So, I mean, I go and I support the other breweries. It's not very nice. All about us. It's about our industry, and our industry is not against each other or against, you know, the Budweisers and Millers, you know, we're against the people that don't really truly make beer. And that's if you get in the industry, that's what you're after. You're after teaming up. So,
It's good to see,
conquering the gorilla and not, you know, beating us up on the street, you know?
Yeah. So, you know, and I think a lot of industries could take that to heart. And when you have a smaller community of businesses sort of versus that giant Walmart type guy, you know,
totally.
So that's good to see. That's something I really enjoy about the brewing industry in our county. And then I was going to ask you a little bit about bottling and canning operations. I know that's something that breweries have to sort of take into account. I know you guys probably aren't doing that yet because you opened recently.
Yes. Yeah, we're looking at by the first of the year, we'll be canning. We'll bottle too, but I think our bottling is going to be limited to the brewery. We totally look at a different marketing strategy when it comes to bottling because bottling is very popular in California, but it's not very popular across the country. A lot of states don't allow you to do bottling. There's different laws in every state. So canning is the way to go also because of cost. And cans last longer. Now breweries are, you know, lining cans so that your beer in there, instead of maybe us worrying about it in a couple of months at a liquor store or whatever, you know, you can be 6 months down the road and still that can, and it's got a quality product in it. Cool. You're not worried about the sun beating on it. You're not worried about the weather that it's in. And then the cost, you know, you're able to ship twice as much product of cans versus bottles. So we look at probably getting into the Costco market with cans before we do even anything in a liquor store. I mean, to find us in a liquor store, I would probably say it's not going to happen right now. I mean, it'd be a little ways down the road.
Okay.
Because of distribution. And another thing, like I was telling you before, we want to treat our customers, and that's from the retailer to the restaurant to the bar, to the people that come in our tasting room. We want to treat them like family, and we want to be there for them. We want to promote the product so they build a customer base and that they want to have our product. And today, as you see, I mean, there's major tap hopping in the beer places. Brand is bouncing all over the place. So if you were a retailer and you were serving our beer for a week or 2 weeks and you had, you know, that 50, 60 customers that came and drank our beer and then all of a sudden you're gone, it's not doing us any benefit at all.
Right.
It doesn't do me any benefit to have 500 customers out there that buy our beer from us, retailers. And only 100 of them or 50 of them are solid customers. So our goal is to have solid places. So if you go like to Eastbound or you go to all the Boll Weevils, our beer is always going to be on tap.
Nice.
And that's how we're picking off places we want, is that we're going to go in there and help you promote. We're going to do everything we can to get your customers in your retail location so that you have a steady stream of customers drinking our product.
Very nice. That's good. I like seeing that level of involvement. It's not just cash a check and forget it. Very nice. Besides the canning operation, what else do you see in the future for Pacific Islander Beer Company?
I think international sales. I think that that is where everybody's, you know, the smart breweries are going international. Gotcha. The volume's there. The payment's there. That's the thing they kind of struggle in the domestic market, getting paid on time. One of the things that we always believe is brand awareness. We buy clothes with brands on them. We buy shoes with brands on them. We buy cars with brands on them. And, and beer is no different. It's not so much, I'm not saying you don't make great beers. You got to make beers that people want to drink.
Of course.
But it's also you want to make great beers that it's a brand that people want to drink. And so a lot of times our whole concept with what we do is to keep pushing our brand and saying that, you know, we totally, I meet with owners in California. We have the CCBA and it's all the owners meet.
Okay.
And so you get a chance to really see, you know, from the Lagunitas's and the Stones and, you know, Walker's Brewery, you know, Firestone
guys.
Walker that just merged, you know, he just sold out. So he's now a bigger craft brewer company, bought them out. But there's a lot of big boys and you get in there and you get a chance to talk to them. And if you're smart enough, you'd be looking where they're looking instead of looking at just your little pool in your neighborhood.
Right.
Yeah, that's basically where PIB will go. We feel that I want you to be excited about drinking our beer, not just in our brewery, but, you know, at the local restaurant, local retailer.
All right. Very cool. Well, I appreciate you coming in. And they're located at 8665 Argent Street in Suite B, and that's Santee. As always, you got to be 21 to drink beer and always drive safe if you are consuming alcohol. Yeah. Thanks a lot for being here, Kuipu. And we will see you at the brewery.
We appreciate it. Much mahalo to all you out there.
Thank you very much.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Leon Thompson with the Green Scene Report. The U.S. Ninth Court of Appeal in San Francisco has revoked the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's approval of the pesticide sulfoxaflor, because it is highly toxic to bees. Pesticide is sold under the brand names Closer and Transform. Sulfoxaflor, a neonicotinoid, was approved by the EPA in 2013. From April 2014 to April 2015, losses of honeybee colonies plunged 42%, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Judge Mary M. Schroeder wrote, "Bees are essential to pollinate important crops, and in recent years have been dying at an alarming rate." The decision concluded, "Given the precariousness of bee populations, leaving the EPA's registration of sulfoxaflor in place risks more potential environmental harm than vacating it." The court ruled that the EPA's approval was made without any meaningful study. Reuters reports that Dow has said it disagrees with the court's decision and will work with the EPA to implement the order and to promptly complete additional regulatory work to support the registration of the products. B bees pollinate 25% of the food consumed in the U.S. The bee decline has prompted a White House task force to study the dire situation. Neonicotinoids are particularly dangerous to bees since some research indicates bees are actually attracted to crops sprayed with neonicotinoids, a nicotine-derived chemical. In California, sulfoxaflor has been approved for use on lettuce crops only, but will now be banned for all crops. Nationwide, it is used to control aphids and other sucking pests on a wide range of crops, including citrus, cotton, strawberries, wheat, and soybeans, among others. While environmental experts have blamed neonicotinoid pesticides for the decimation of the bee populations, the chemical industry has contended that the decline is caused by other factors, such as bee mite infestation.
How you gonna keep 'em down on the farm after they seem hairy?
This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine's Agricultural Report. Now here's the buzz. The County Board of Supervisors has unanimously approved new rules Wednesday that will promote beekeeping and local agriculture. Supervisors approved a new tiered beekeeping ordinance that will allow beekeeping hobbyists and businesses to keep bees and hives closer to roads, property lines, and homes in unincorporated areas of the county, but still far enough away to keep people safe. Bees not only produce honey, they are an essential part of plant reproduction, carrying pollen from plant to plant. Commercial beekeeping businesses pollinate avocado, broccoli, onion, fruit, and seed crops across San Diego County. Biologists and beekeepers worldwide have been sounding alarm since 2006 that bees are disappearing, with blame placed on pesticides and parasitic mites. County supervisors wanted to find ways to promote beekeeping, economic development, and protect both bees and the public. The new beekeeping ordinance creates three tiers of distance regulations for beekeepers. Current regulations require everyone, small and large beekeepers, to keep their hives 100 feet from roads and 600 feet, that's two full football fields, away from homes. The new ordinance will allow backyard beekeeping hobbyists in general to keep two hives within 25 feet of roads and property lines, 35 feet from neighboring homes, and 150 feet from sensitive sites where there may be small children, the elderly, animals, or others who could be physically challenged. Small commercial beekeeping companies will be allowed to have up to 20 hives, but the setbacks will be farther. While large commercial beekeeping companies will be able to have unlimited hives, set back 100 feet from roads, 300 feet from homes, and 450 feet from sensitive places. The ordinance will also institute a beekeeping education and outreach program. Supervisor Diane Jacob, who brought the issue to the board, said, "I would urge all the beekeepers, the current ones and future ones, to go make that honey." The ordinance is set to be heard again by the board on September 30th for a second reading and will take effect in 30 days if the board approves that second reading. The county's agriculture weights and measures officials said they would return to the board in 2018 to update supervisors on how the ordinance is working. Department officials at the direction of the board said they will also continue looking for chances to lease county-owned properties to beekeepers. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.